And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Monday. Bonnie, the best laid plans
do often go awry, I guess
well,
you would say.
They certainly have today. We've been trying to get in touch with Austin Ivory, who was the author of The Great Reformer, Francis and the Making of a Radical Pope, and we're having all kinds of technical difficulties.
He's in England.
Hooking up with him now. But we do have a very interesting interview conducted by our literary contributor, Ariel Gonzalez.
Yes, he is interviewing Jim Shepherd, who's written the book, The Book of Aaron is the name of it. It's a Holocaust book, and it's a great addition to the genre. This being the Jewish New Year, we thought that we would play that for you now
Indeed.
That this has happened.
Indeed. Thanks for your indulgence.
Yeah, and we're very sorry. We were looking forward to the interview.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks so much for joining us. In his new novel, The Book of Aaron, Jim Shepherd looks at the Warsaw Ghetto through the eyes of a Jewish boy who has to close his heart in order to survive. But when he loses his family, he's sent to an orphanage run by a saintly Polish doctor who tries to reawaken the boy's faith in humanity, despite the daily evidence to the contrary all around them. A widely praised addition to the genre of Holocaust literature, The Book of Aaron is a heartbreaking tale that treats readers like adults, which means what it lacks in happy endings, it makes up for in unvarnished truth. Shepherd is also celebrated for historical short fiction that reveals a kaleidoscope imagination. His research is formidable. If he needs to, he'll read 40 books to write a 25-page story. It's this commitment to exactitude that has earned him the praise of his peers. He has yet to reach the bestseller list, so critics may be right when they call him the best writer in America that you've never heard of. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Jim Shepherd. He began by asking him how he first became aware of the orphanage in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Oh, I probably learned of it at a very young age because I was the sort of odd child who read stuff about catastrophe from a very early age. And if you're drawn to man-made catastrophe the way I am, you get to the Holocaust pretty quickly as a subject. So probably a couple years into my reading about the Holocaust, I came across the orphanage in the ghetto and read the story of Korshak's walk with the children. But it didn't stand out for me much more than any, 100 other sorts of amazing, heartbreaking, harrowing stories that came out of just the ghetto alone would have stood out. So it took me a long time to come back to it.
But when did you decide to write a novel about it?
I decided to write a novel about it about 4 years ago. What happened was I write about a weird array of stuff. And because of that, old students and friends, when they come across something that they think is an odd story, they'll often send it to me and say, hey, you might want to write about this, or why haven't you written about this? And in this case, an old student wrote me and said, why have you never written about Janusz Korczak? And I wrote him back and said, well, I'm always a little hesitant to write about sort of great men and women of history, and especially saints, partially because I'm drawn to a sort of worm's eye view of history, because I think that's the view most of us have. And I'm interested in our relationship, that helpless feeling we have when we feel like we're at the hands of somebody else's power as opposed to feeling powerful ourselves, because I'm interested in getting at the way we are complicitous with power. That's one reason. But another reason is when you're writing about saintly figures, whether it's like Gandhi or Dorothy Day or Korczak or Jesus from close up, it's very hard, I think, to find a conflict that's commensurate with their saintliness. You know, it's like, well, Gandhi's an amazing guy, but he has domestic troubles, or so when the student, old student said to me, why haven't you written about him? I wrote him back and told him that. And then I'm also the kind of odd person who actually has Korczak's Ghetto Diary in my house. And so I thought, well, read it again.
You had it before.
Oh, yeah, I had it before. And I'd read it before, and I read it again thinking, I haven't read it in a while. Remind yourself about this guy. And I came across a story about a boy who had been, whose mother had said she would stay alive long enough to get him into the orphanage. She was 10 years old. And she hung on for a long time. And then finally, when an opening appeared and he was admitted to Korshak's orphanage, she died immediately. And he, of course, blamed Korshak and was inconsolable for weeks and screamed for 3 days straight, apparently. And I remember thinking, reading that, of course, almost everybody in the orphanage was absolutely miserable being there. Even though when you read survivors' testimonies, and there are a few survivors, because if you had to graduate the orphanage at 14, and if you did that before the liquidation of the ghetto or even the closing of the ghetto and got out, you might well have survived. When you read those people's accounts, they're all you know, reverent and say he was an amazing man and blah, blah, blah. But it occurred to me that at the time, nobody wanted to be there. In fact, everyone was pretty miserable. And poor Korshak spent almost all of his time, even though he was so selfless, giving them bad news. You know, he didn't have much good news to give them. So the idea that you would be someone who made a saint's life harder, the idea that you would be someone who understood that this person had saved your life but still couldn't fully appreciate it because of every other miserable thing that had happened to you, that seemed to me a really interesting way into this subject, and that's where the novel began.
We're speaking with Jim Shepherd, whose new novel is The Book of Aaron. For people who don't know, tell us something about Janusz Korczak.
Korczak was primarily known as an educational reformer, and he introduced a radical idea in Western Europe at the beginning of the 20th century that children were human beings, and they had an inherent dignity, and that their education should be at least partially in their hands, and pleasure should be taken into account as well. So the idea that you might want to consult with children about the best ways to teach, the idea that you might want to consult with children about their own sort of rhythms, do you want to take a break now, that kind of thing. And the idea that children, the best way to respond to children at all times was not punishment. Those were all in some ways radical ideas. And he promoted them very actively and successfully across Europe and sort of changed elementary school education in Europe, and was about to retire in the late 30s. He also had become enough of a celebrity that he was a very famous children's book author and a radio personality as well. He was considered very humorous and a sort of father figure on the radio. I mean, it's hard to find an analog in American culture, but it would be like if you imagine Dr. Spock and Dr. Seuss and Garrison Keillor all rolled into one. He was sort of a big celebrity. And he also was important because it was sort of an open secret that he was Jewish. And so he helped bring the Poles and the Jews together. He was ready to retire around 1939, and the Germans invaded.
Well, the Nazis were aware of him.
Quite aware
of
him.
In fact, some respected him.
For a Jew, they respected him quite a lot, yeah. And in fact, they dealt with him directly. And it was a measure of their respect for him that at one point he went to the German authorities and accused them of stealing his potatoes. And for his temerity, he was, you know, beaten and thrown into a Gestapo jail, but they let him out after a month because they respected him enough, and they thought, let him work with the kids in the orphanage for a while.
And he had more than one opportunity to escape.
One of the things that made him an amazing figure, but also made him an interestingly complicated figure to me, was how messianic he really was about his children. He had many chances to escape. And a number of people said to him, you know, you could actually do more good on the outside of the ghetto than on the inside. And he refused. He also was approached towards the end more than once, we know, to try to rally support for resistance. And he wouldn't do that either because he was so dedicated to his children. So he was messianic and devoted in a way that was both admirable and a little complicated.
Mm-hmm. And not giving anything away by saying
right.
that.
Spoiler alert.
Well, it's not really a spoiler right. that, you know, it does not end happily.
Right.
There is a trip to Treblinka mm-hmm. at the end. We don't show it. You don't show it to us.
Right.
But we know it's coming. There's a passage I'd like you to read from your book where Korczak, we first really see him. I mean, we've seen him a couple times before
right.
this scene, but I think it's the scene where we really actually see the man in action. Could you read it for us?
Sure. And this is to set it up. You know, one of the things he would do is he tried to make everything that the children had to experience as much of an event and as much of a part of their creative life as he could. So when the children were forced to move into from a much nicer orphanage into the ghetto, he turned it into essentially a children's parade. And the passage, he had them all make their own parade floats and all of that. And the passage I'm going to read is our protagonist seeing this for the first time. On the day of the deadline, Lutek and I spotted a wagon filled with magical loot, a gilded birdcage, a set of knives, and a sunburst pattern in an open display case, and followed it until we had to give up because the crowds were so impossible. Lutek got mad and climbed a lamppost to search out other opportunities, while I hung onto it below him. Then we heard a fanfare of horns and pie pans, and the gates of the courtyard opposite us opened, and two old janitors somehow managed to part the mob on the sidewalk. And a row of kids with horns and tin pans and wooden spoons turned onto the street in a line. A boy in the center held a staff with a bright green flag and a Jewish star in a harness around his waist. More lines came out of the darkness behind them, kids of all sizes holding toys and books against their chests and singing. "What is it?" Lutek asked. We couldn't hear what they were singing, but the kids kept coming, at least 20 rows of them, followed by wagons piled high with wicker baskets tied with cords and cast iron pots and flowered breadboards and trunks tied with rope, crates of books and ladles and strainers, and then a wagon mounded with coal and another with potatoes. Other kids and adults wrestled over the coal and potatoes that scattered onto the cobblestones when the wagons turned onto the street. All of the wagons had red geraniums in window boxes along their sides, and beneath them decorations made from streamers. The wagon drivers were wearing homemade bird masks with plumes and feathers. We pushed closer and heard someone say it was Korczak's orphanage that had been forced to move. And then there he was, with his bald head and yellowish goatee again, the last one out before the courtyard gates swung shut behind him. He was pulling the heavy woman along by the arm and struggling to keep up with the last wagon. She was as tall as he was and seemed more frightened by the crowds. They were pushed into our path, and for a while we were carried along behind them. I wondered if he would recognize me, but he didn't. He and the heavy woman had to shout at each other to be heard. She asked how long he thought he could go without sleeping, and he shouted back that when he was a young man, his mother had come into his room in mid-afternoon and dragged him out of bed by his feet. She asked if that was how I wanted to become a doctor, he shouted, by staying out all night long. And I told her, a doctor? I thought I was studying to become a lush. We followed them to the gate at the small ghetto at Kłodno, where the German and Polish police were checking identification. All of the orphanage wagons had passed through except the one with the potatoes, which sat still next to the guard hut. The driver had his hands on his hips and was watching two Polish policemen unhitch his horse. He'd pulled his bird mask down and it hung below his chin. A feather fluttered alongside his ear. "What's happening?" Korczak asked the Polish policeman in front of us. "Why has my wagon not gone through?" "It isn't your wagon," one of the German policemen told him. "It's my wagon." They argued in German about it. The heavy woman was terrified and tried to pull Korczak through the gate, but he knocked her arm away. He shouted something at the German and then repeated it to the Polish policeman, that if the German didn't release the potatoes, he would report the theft to their superiors. The German's bored expression disappeared, and he said in Polish, "So you're trying to frighten me, Jew?" And Lutek gave my shirt such a pull from behind that he ripped it. "Are you with him?" a Polish policeman said, stepping in front of us. He pointed a baton at Korczak. "Is he drunk?" "I don't know what he is," I told him, and Lutek pulled me again, and a woman with a chicken in a straw cage shouldered forward and almost knocked the policeman off his feet. He clubbed her once and then twice, and Lutek shouted into my ear, "What do you think this is, a show?" and yanked me so hard that I fell to my knees, and then he pulled me to my feet and dragged me down the street.
Thank you. We have to take a break. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and we're speaking to Jim Shepherd, author of Book of Aaron. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. We're speaking today with Jim Shepherd, novelist and short story writer whose new book, The Book of Aaron, is set during the time of the Holocaust, specifically the Warsaw Ghetto. Jim, the narrator of the novel is a boy. Mm-hmm. Now, Jodine Brooks, who wrote the review of your book for the New York Times Book Review, who praised it, mm-hmm. did have one criticism. she wishes that you had made Korshak the narrator, or at least seen it through his eyes.
Right.
You chose to look at everything through the boy's eyes. Why?
Right. You know, as I was saying before, I'm very interested in those figures in history that we usually brush aside. And I understand the impulse behind saying, oh, why not choose the most important person in the ghetto or the most interesting person in the ghetto? But in a way, there's something that makes me ethically uneasy about that. You know, it's the idea is, in narrative terms, of course, what she was referring to is, well, wouldn't you learn a lot more if you had this person as narrator? But in emotional terms, too, there's that quality of the reader saying, well, I'd like to be rooting for somebody who's quite important and powerful, in relative terms anyway. And I'm interested very much in those figures that got swept away as unimportant in this Holocaust. And in fact, one of the things that I'm very moved by are these figures that in the very early going, it was decided, well, they weren't worth very much anyway. They were orphans. They were uneducated. They were whatever. And, you know, one of the awful things that the Germans forced the Jews to do, or certainly induced the Jews to do, those Jews that were working with the Germans, was to make those kinds of distinctions. You know, you have to pick out 40% of your units and send them off to Treblinka. And it was a very difficult impulse to resist, because at first you thought, oh, that's a monstrous idea. I won't decide who lives and who dies. But then you'd also think, well, wait, you know, Ariel has 5 children and Bill doesn't have any, you know, and Bill's not doing well anyway physically. So why don't we just pick Bill, you know, that kind of thing. And that kind of selection is very seductive. And I think that in some ways we do it in narrative terms, too. We sort of say, well, I'd rather read about this person than that person's just a child. My sense of what a child could narrate about the ghetto was more than enough to learn about what that experience was like, I think. And,
well, a lot of Holocaust fiction is told from a child's point mm-hmm. of view. Louis Begley's Wartime Lies,
right.
his memoir, and, of course, The Painted Bird,
yep.
Jerzy Kosinski. You know, there's that sense of the most horrible thing happening that can imagine to a child.
Right.
He's seeing everything. He's losing his innocence.
Yeah.
As opposed to an adult who, well, you know, we've already lost our values and principles.
Well, there's also a way in which I think that the sort of impossible facts of the Holocaust, the very stupefying nature of it, make children of us all. And so there's a way in which we actually find ourselves as adults in that position of just staring mute the way children do. And children are also valuable in narrative terms as a way of controlling the sort of sensational aspects of affect and rhetoric, because when you see something absolutely mind-bendingly horrible happen as an adult, you feel like you have to process it in terms that's adequate to the horror of it sometimes. And as a lot of the writers you just mentioned have figured out, children have ways of insulating themselves through a kind of simplicity in their language that in some ways helps the writer maintain a kind of control over the melodrama.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jim Shepherd about his new novel, The Book of Aaron. Aaron, because some Holocaust films and novels, they tend to have this before and after effect. In other words, before everything was nice,
right,
special,
right.
You know, again, because usually sometimes it's a family that's middle class, well-educated,
right.
We're celebrating, we have books, everything is nice, and then the horror comes.
Right.
But in Aaron's case, no, things are not good before.
Right. One of the things that really struck me when I was doing research for this, and I know there are lots and lots of primary accounts of childhoods in Poland and Jewish childhoods and Polish childhoods, and but especially the Jewish children. Well, one of the things that really struck me was how much poverty and how much difficulty most Jewish children had in Poland. And, you know, that was another way into this for me. It struck me that there was, in some ways, now that the Holocaust has become a kind of genre, thanks to Steven Spielberg, there was a kind of model of an Edenic sort of prehistory. You know, we all sat around singing Sunrise, Sunset, and we all loved one another very much.
Fiddler on the Roof.
Right. And then the Germans came and just wrecked everything. And I'm sure that was the case for a lot of well-to-do and middle-class Jews. But of course, most Jews in Poland were not allowed to be well-to-do and middle-class. Most Jews in Poland were grindingly poor and very miserable with all of the dysfunctions that came with that. And so over and over again, when I was reading these journals, I would come across, you know, reactions to the German invasion like, oh, great, what else can happen? You know, as opposed to, oh, my God, our Eden is about to be destroyed. You know, it was like sometimes one boy I remember, he was like 12 or 13, and his mother said something like, the Germans have invaded. And he said, well, that's perfect. It's like that's the best end to this week ever, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, you do have humor in the novel, you know. And again, the whole idea of Jewish humor, which is, you know, you laugh as, the catastrophe is taking place.
Right, right.
Which, again, some people, especially like Israelis, react hostily to that. Mm-hmm. The idea that, no, that's diaspora humor. That's what got us into this mess to begin with.
Right, right.
But when you're incorporating humor into this, such a horrible situation, how difficult was it for you, or was it?
You know, it wasn't difficult because it wasn't a matter of thinking, wow, this is such bleak material, I'd better add some leavening of comedy. What it was going over these texts over and over again, and, you know, again, there are a lot of journals from the Warsaw Ghetto, and a lot of, again, childhood accounts. And going over these texts over and over again, you're struck by how much humor there is in them. And part of the reason for that, I think, is when you're dealing with that kind of brutality and that kind of need for emotional resourcefulness, you either, in the face of all of those losses, start to become sociopathic. You either start to decide, you know, it doesn't matter who's dying, I'm going to eat my bread. Or you start to deal with the black absurdity of it. You start to try and find humor wherever you can, essentially. And I ended up putting, you know, two or three sort of elaborate jokes that are right out of the Warsaw Ghetto into the novel, just because I thought, well, this actually is quite eloquent about the way they were thinking. I mean, there was a genre of Hitler jokes inside the ghetto, you know, and it was like the standard Hitler joke is, you know, began something like, okay, Hitler is trying to do everything, the worst possible things he can do to the Jews. So he does A, he does B, he does C, he does D, and then the punchline is, you know, E or something.
Well, with Aaron, I see that, at the, you know, throughout most of the novel, he has to close off his heart.
Mm-hmm.
Because of everything that's going on, because he's a survivor. He is a survivor.
Right.
And as a survivor, you know, there's a price for survival.
Right.
You know, you're going to, you know, it's like that line from the novel I read years ago, Damage. Damaged people are dangerous.
Right.
They know you can survive. And but then toward the end, he has to rediscover his heart.
Right.
Doesn't he?
Yeah. And in fact, one of the things that struck me about the design of the book as it started to develop was, it really is in some ways, and this is also why there's a capacity for both enlightenment and surprise at the ending, even though we think, well, this can't end well, right? There's a way in which, because he's a young person, the story actually becomes a kind of coming-of-age story, but a coming-of-age story in which the Germans don't allow the final part of the arc to happen, essentially. And it occurred to me that, of course, that's also the way people experience the Holocaust, not as all of these things happen and then the Germans came and that was this end point, but as much as, oh, there were all these narratives that were developing that they thought was the narrative of their life, and then the Germans shut all of them down at once, essentially. There's a wonderful line by Vladimir Nabokov in a short story of his called Signs and Symbols, where he says something like, you know, at that point, Aunt Rosa, who was fussy and unhappy about everything, you know, Aunt Rosa was fussy and unhappy about all of her relatives until the Germans came along and put an end to her and all the relatives she cared about, you know, and you have the sense suddenly of all these stories ending, you know.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Jim Shepherd. This is Eric Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLON. Welcome back. This is Eric Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLON. Our guest today is Jim Shepherd, novelist and short story writer whose new novel, The Book of Aaron, is set in the Warsaw Ghetto during the Holocaust. Jim, in addition to being a novelist, you're also an esteemed short story writer.
That's good to hear.
No, you are. I mean, you know, and again, you have this terrible label attached to you, which is your writer's writer.
Yeah.
And what is a writer's writer? Someone who doesn't make any money from their writing, usually. But who other writers, especially those who do make a lot of money, praise tremendously.
Right.
So you get lots of praise from people like Jonathan Lethem, Michael Chabon, others.
Right.
But they make millions. But about your short stories, again, you do a tremendous amount of research for some of these stories because many of them are historical. You do enough research for novels.
Oh, very much, for example.
There's one story called Netherlands Lives with Water, where I think you read over 40 books just to write this 25-page short story.
And then went to Rotterdam as well.
And went to the Netherlands to write a 25. And I'm sure, you know, you had enough for a novel there.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And in terms of efficiency, this is, I think we'd have to call it a very bad method. And in fact, I have a novelist friend, Ron Hansen, who, when he caught sight of one of my research folders for one of those stories, said, "You're out of your mind. You know, I could get a trilogy out of what you make for a short story. And I said to him, "But remember, I'm putting less food on my children's plate, and that's what's important." also, in terms of working with short stories, you know, that way I know I'm at the white hot center of American culture, right? Because everybody cares about short stories. So.
Well, don't be too sarcastic about it, because I think they are coming back because ebooks.
I wonder if ebooks will help in that regard.
I have great faith in you know, a lot of people put down ebooks, but I think that ebooks will be the redemption for short stories and novellas.
Oh, that'd be wonderful if that happened.
Because it's the perfect form for novellas.
And suddenly novellas aren't a problem anymore because it doesn't matter with ebooks what length it is.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. But let's talk. Okay, Netherlands with Water is set in the near future.
Right.
Where the polar ice caps are mostly melted.
Right.
And now everybody else is looking to the Netherlands for instruction on how to deal with flood control because they've been dealing with it for centuries.
Right.
And it has a very, you know, timely message.
Well, it's literally what's happening now, essentially.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Dutch, the very same Dutch that I met with, and one of the things that's wonderful and touching about the Dutch is if you say you're a short story writer and you want to learn about their water defenses, they'll actually have people in the government and in the private sector come and meet with you, even though you're just a short story writer. But anyway, the people that I met with are now actually working with St. Petersburg. They're working with London. They're working with New York. They're working with Venice. One of the only cities, in fact, they said they couldn't help was Miami, which we can talk about later if you'd like. But what that meant was there was an enormous amount of research that had to do with imagining a future that it turned out is hurtling towards us even more quickly anyway. You know, my story, I think, is set in 2025 or 2050, maybe 2050, one of the two. And
the mid-century.
And what's happening is the feedback loops that scientists were worried about are kicking in now, and things are accelerating exactly the way I think the most pessimistic people feared it would, essentially.
Well, you also have an interesting story called The Gun Lobby, which I don't know when it was written, but it was very disturbing. it's set in Waterbury, Connecticut, which is not too far from Newtown.
Oh, no, this was written probably 20 years before Newtown.
Okay, but, you know, there's an interesting coincidence.
Right. Well, it turns out that if you, like me, write a lot about man-made catastrophe, you're pretty much going to be correct somewhere down the line.
Somebody's going to catch up.
Which is why I do this in some ways, because I do want to believe that literature has some utility in our culture. And here's another example. I finished a Book of Aaron maybe over a year ago because I delivered it to the publisher. And I started working on something new. And one of the things that I'd been obsessed about is our railroad infrastructure and the way it's been breaking down. So I'm researching, and then Philadelphia happens, right? And so then people go, "Oh, well, you jumped on that bandwagon." And I'm like, "Yeah, in a way."
No, the bandwagon caught up with
the
me.
The bandwagon caught up with me, yeah.
Well, you wrote a novel called Project X, which also deals with guns.
Right.
It's about school shooting.
Right.
And again, you have from a point of view of a boy, and you really capture his alienation, mm-hmm. his disaffection. I mean, all of us were boys.
Right.
I mean, every male was a boy. But how we were able, did you, I mean, because George Saunders has this story where about teenage girls where he actually got the where they talked by following girls in a mall. And I told him, you know, you're lucky you weren't arrested.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
Did you hang out in high schools?
I did hang out in high schools because, I mean, first of all, it was based on a lot of this incredibly dysfunctional kids that I went to school with, because I went to a really bad junior high and high school. One of the reasons I hung out in high schools when I was writing a novel is I didn't want to write a historical novel about the situation. I wanted to write a contemporary novel. So I wanted to make sure that the dysfunctions that I remembered from my high school were still operating. So I sat in on a public high school in Massachusetts and a private high school in Los Angeles, and was relieved and not relieved to discover that the same dysfunctions were still operating, essentially. And one of the things that sitting in on those schools reminded me that I was able to put into Project X was all of that awful stuff in high school that you repress, that's part of the decor, like, you know, those hideous motivational posters. So you come in and you're utterly alienated and you're utterly depressed, and you think if you see one more thing that has anything to do with cheering up, you're going to kill somebody. And then it's like there's a little kitty hanging there and says, you know, hang in there, you know. And that I had forgotten how much high schools are all about that, you know, as a way of pretending that they're moving you along a certain track, you know.
Well, we're speaking with Jim, novelist and short story writer Jim Shepherd. I love the short stories that you write that deal with movies.
Oh, good.
Nosferatu, which is told from the point of view of F.W. Murnau. People who don't know Nosferatu, it's a classic German expressionist film. The first adaptation of Dracula came out in 1922. But what's fascinating to me is, again, how you're able to find something. It's not just a story of the making of a movie, because Murnau was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And vampirism becomes almost a metaphor for his closet or his homosexuality.
Right.
I mean, at one point he says it's, you know, that it's important that the vampire, everyone must see him as not out of the ordinary.
Right.
And Murnau's really talking about himself.
Yeah.
In that story.
And in fact, one of the things that I try to do is have the metaphor operate in various ways, right? So he'll think of the metaphor in that way. And we'll also think when we're reading it, oh, you know, there's something parasitic about Murnau's personality, even though it has nothing to do with his homosexuality. There's a way in which he's quite cold. There's a way in which he takes advantage of people as a director. There's a way in which he does all of these things that he'd be shocked to discover that's the way he's viewed. But in fact, there's all sorts of complicated reasons he's drawn to a figure like that, some of which are metaphors he's worked out. Oh, this is clearly a way I can get at my sexuality without ever having to make it explicit, and some of which he hasn't.
You also wrote a wonderful story called The Creature of the Black Lagoon, where you tell it's from the point of view
from
of the
point
the
of
creature.
View of the creature, yeah.
So you take this B movie, which is not very good.
Right.
But you also show the complete alienation of this character. He really is the last of his kind.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been the last of his kind for so long. And so you feel sympathy for him, even though he is a monster.
Well, the pathos of that position, there's this wonderful moment in the B-movie where they go, well, he's a holdover from the Devonian, which is, of course, impossibly long ago. It's like, you know, millions of years before the dinosaurs. And he's been the only one of his kind forever. And you just think, what a hilariously dark situation, right? You've been hanging out by yourself in the jungle for 500 million years, you know. And then the idea that I could have a little bit of black comedy with that, but also start to get at the way in which somebody who's that alienated starts to feel they have license to do whatever they want to do, is, I think, the way you move into monstrousness, you know. I intend for that story to be quite fun to read, but also disturbing.
Well, it is.
Okay.
We need to take a break.
Okay.
When we return, we'll continue speaking with Jim Shepherd. This is Eric Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ara Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLIN. We're here today with novelist and short story writer Jim Shepherd, whose new book, The Book of Aaron, is a novel set in the Warsaw Ghetto during World War II. Speaking of war, Jim, you've written about war in some of these short stories, mm-hmm. these historical short stories. For example, Hadrian's Wall, mm-hmm. which is told from the point of view of a Roman soldier who is occupying England, well, at least the Britannia at that time. There was no England back then. But to me, again, maybe I'm misreading it, it was, again, a metaphor for some of the things happening today.
Oh, yeah. No, you're not misreading it. And in fact, he's not exactly a Roman soldier. He's a Roman auxiliary. And auxiliaries were essentially the countries that the Romans had conquered that they then turned around and used to conquer other countries. They sort of recruited troops from those countries. And that imperial project of sort of, you're our friends, now you're going to do our bidding by inflicting violence on our next enemies, that really interested me. And the way in which our current imperial project in America resembles the Roman project is not too hard to figure out. And in fact, there's a line that one of the men says about Romans that seems to me very indicative of Americans, and that is he says at one point, talking about how enraged the Romans were by a surprise attack, he says, "Romans suffer casualties like they've never had casualties before," essentially. And, you know, when you think about American exceptionalism, when you think about how 9/11 completely changed our psyche and we'll never forget it and blah, 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 you know, because, oh, my God, we lost people at 9/11. And you think about all these other countries saying, oh, my God, welcome to the world. This is how it works. You know, you get a sense of how much an imperial power says, but we are not like the other world. That's that's why we're an imperial power. We make our own rules, essentially. We're going to change the rules as we want to change the rules.
And I love the way that story ends. When the auxiliary says, "We honor nothing by being the way we are. We make a desolation and we call it peace." Mm.
That was actually a quote from a German chieftain who was – somebody had said to the German chieftain, you know, you got to hand it to the Romans. There's no more wars after they come through town. And he said, they make a desolation and they call it peace, essentially.
Well, the same thing you mentioned, again, 9/11 and the way we reacted after that. I got a sense of that in your story on the French Revolution. Saint-Farin, which is told from the point of view of the official executioner.
The hereditary executioner. How would you like to have that job handed
down
to you?
Yeah, like his family, it goes back several generations. But he was the man who executed many of the
Pretty much everybody during the Reign of Terror.
During the Reign of Terror. And the way he describes it, again, is this idea of national security. Mm-hmm. We have to, you know, protect the nation. We don't know who is the law of suspects.
Right.
Anybody could be a traitor. And we have to get rid of everybody.
And in fact, it got even more lunatic than that, because the man who developed the guillotine, whose name was Guillotine, had done that as a humanitarian gesture, because beheadings were so gruesome and so difficult. And if the headsman didn't know what he was doing with his axe or his sword, he usually had to do two or three strokes, and it was a horrible mess. And it was people would, you know, even the people who came out to see it would have their stomachs turned. So Guillotine came up with this idea, well, what about if we had this painless, theoretically, very, very swift way of cutting off heads? And what he forgot was that the revolutionaries who were obsessed with we have to make sure that we eliminate all threats would now have something that would allow them to kill somebody every 2 or 3 minutes as opposed to a headsman who had to actually resharpen the axe. And so you couldn't have mass killings by the state until you had the guillotine, essentially. And once they had the guillotine, suddenly mass killings by the state followed, as though now that we can do it, we will do it.
Well, it reminds me of your story, Minotaur, which is very contemporary.
And speaking of being ahead of the curve, it's about drones.
It's about drones.
And
it's
20 years old.
Again, the narrator is a man, a scientist of some kind, who works at an Area 51-like base.
Right.
and he's designing drones. And he, you know, it's the whole morality of that issue.
Well, not only the morality, but one of the things that struck me when I first wrote it, and that was, again, that was years ago at this point, was I happened to come across a line item in the Department of Defense budget that said black ops, and it just had the budget number, and the budget number was staggering. And I thought, where is all this money going? And I started researching it, and it turns out it was going into R&D for stuff like drones, which were, even then, in a very primitive sense, were being used against, theoretically, against terrorist targets. But of course, the intelligence was never very good. So it's like, we hear that there's a terrorist driving a Toyota on this road. We think that's a Toyota. We took it out. We took out the three cars around it. I think we got him, you know. My narrator, which is sort of at the dawn of the sort of drone age. And again, I had thought drones were a terrifying thing, but even it didn't occur to me that they were going to become quite the. It should have, but it didn't occur to me they were going to become quite the
arm of the state. Yeah, but they're going to be ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous, yeah.
Because they're going to be used commercially.
Right.
They're going to be used for surveillance.
Right.
Everything.
Right.
They're the wave of the future.
Yeah. I mean, I should have seen them as the wave of the future, partially because Americans have always been, really since World War II, have been obsessed with the notion of a surgical war and obsessed with the notion of a war that will that can be waged without American casualties. And the drone is, of course, the perfect apparatus for that, people think, because it's I'm in a room, I'm safe, right? But, of course, the PTSD rates for drone pilots have been off the charts. I mean, these people are breaking down at a much faster rate than fighter pilots.
Well, speaking with novelist and short story writer Jim Shepherd, on a lighter note, one of the funniest stories that I feel you wrote was the one on the rock band The Who.
Oh, yes.
Won't Get Fooled Again.
Right.
And here, your narrator is John Entwistle,
of The Who,
the bassist.
Right.
Did you write that before or after he died?
I wrote it right before he died. And in fact, it was published in Playboy. And the editor who published it knew Entwistle and said, you know, I'm going to send this to John. And I said, oh, my God, go ahead. Because I was a huge Who fan. And he
Did he reply?
He sent it to Entwistle, and Entwistle died that week.
Maybe he wrote your story.
I'm gonna let you guess that that's what happened, essentially.
It's hilarious. I think it's a hilarious story.
Who did a lot of crazy things
that I didn't know. Right. I had no idea Roger Daltrey was such.
Was such a thug.
He's a thug. Yeah. He was beating everybody up, especially his bandmates.
Yeah, in fact, there's a comment in the liner notes of Who's Next where. Pete Townsend says something like he tried to take some of Daltrey's chips and Daltrey stuck a fork through his hand.
but it also shows, again, this was a band that was, the way he's described in the story, maybe not that good in terms of their musical talent. But there's one thing that your character, your narrator says, rage in the service of self-pity was what we'd always been about. It was what rock had always been about.
Right.
And I think that's so spot on, because when you look at rock, essentially that is it.
I mean, it's adolescent boys. You can't function on self-pity unless you do those sort of horrible ballads, you know, like Bobby Goldsboro or something like that. So rock had to run on rage, but it still eventually comes back to self-pity. It comes back to, you know, where's my girlfriend? Where's my money? Where's my whatever? And The Who, I think, were very, very good at expressing rage and very, very good at expressing self-pity through the rage. And they also, I think, were – by the time they got to Tommy and Quadrophenia and those albums, they were pretty self-conscious about it. They kind of knew what engine was driving this bus, essentially.
And was there anyone more self-destructive than Keith Moon?
No, there was never anybody more self-destructive than Keith. and you know, it really meant very well, you know, always – always shocked that people were upset when he drove the Cadillac into the pool, or when he threw everything out of the window,
blew up bathrooms, toilets.
You know, he would address as a Nazi stormtrooper and come to parties and be stunned that he offended anybody. You know, because he really did have in some ways a 10-year-old sensibility.
I have to ask you, do you, I mean, and don't take this personally, do you, do you have attention deficit disorder? I'll tell you why, because I can't place you as a writer.
Right.
There are
place.
Other writers I can place.
Right.
Juno Diaz, Dominicus, and Machismo.
Right. Right.
But you, I don't know what you're going to write about next. You will write about anything. Again, the Who one moment, right. The French Revolution the next.
It's true.
I mean,
and I think that's actually hurt my sales over the years, because booksellers have said to me that, you know, people will come in and they'll say, who should I read? And they'll say, Jim Shepherd. And they'll go, well, what's the stuff like? And they'll go, well, you know, it's complicated. And then they lose them right there, right? And now maybe they start to say, well, he tends to do historical stuff or blah, blah, blah. But really, because I was all over the map, I couldn't be branded. And because I couldn't be branded, often I wasn't being sold. But I want to, you know, I want to go on to the thing that interests me next, essentially. I don't want to write. You know, I don't want to write about something just because I used to write about it. I want to write about something because it's going to make me a more interesting human being.
Well, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Jim Shepherd.
And thanks for listening this hour. Ariel Gonzalez is a professor at Miami-Dade College. He writes in the Huffington Post and the Miami Herald. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction provided by online producer Paul Leary. And of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, wlrn.org. More information and links at our website, wlrn.org. Also, a special birthday recognition this afternoon. My co-host, Bonnie Berman. Happy birthday, Bonnie.
Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure to work with you. I enjoy it so much.
So do I.
Enjoy your friendship.
So do I.
And you certainly don't look 39. And don't miss us tomorrow. We'll visit with the outspoken playwright, novelist, and former San Francisco Examiner, Salon, and New York Times columnist, Cintra Wilson. She'll discuss her philosophy of fashion as expressed in her book, Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. What do the togs we put on in the morning say about ourselves?
What do they say, Joe?
Well, mine aren't very exciting.
Oh, okay.
You have a lot of imagination in your dress, though. Huh? Also, our apologies for not presenting our program with the author of the Pope Francis biography.
Austin Ivory.
We tried our best.
We did. Actually, we may be able to still have that. He's in Havana waiting for the Pope's arrival.
He's our man in Havana.
He is, and we're going to try and have that interview on Wednesday, if possible.
Yeah, we'll try. Again, check out our website, wlrn.org, for information about how you can download free audio archives.
Now, I want you to dress very nattily for our interview tomorrow, Joe.
Oh, yes.
Okay, even though Cintra Wilson won't be here.
Yeah, I'll wear my short sleeve shirt.